I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 104 of Season 6 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Father David Lowry, the chaplain of the Movies by Minute community. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I had to tell the people at Mass yesterday that while they may not use money in heaven, it comes in pretty handy down here. And so we needed to encourage a sense of generosity to make sure that we were able to keep the lights on.
Okay, so just pass around the hat, you're saying.
it's important to give people a chance to be charitable.
Understandable. I agree. Charity is very important. Especially to help Clarence Oddbody or George Bailey, whoever's in need. Okay, so Minute 104 begins with George trying to explain or trying to understand the differences between heaven and earth, and ends with Clarence shocked by George's statement. So yesterday we ended things with George sort of making fun of the fact that Clarence said that in heaven they don't use money. And his response is, well, it comes in pretty handy down here, bub. And the response is,
oft-quoted line in the Maori household. This line is probably more than anything else from It's a Wonderful Life gets thrown around my family. We would be in the habit of watching this movie every single year for Christmas. And whenever we run into something like, we don't really use that, it's something that someone has just kind of tossed up, like, oh, yeah, that's not very useful. We often in the family respond with, like, well, it comes in pretty handy down here, bub.
Are you familiar with the term bub?
In that it is a very 1940s-ism, yes, kind of a shortened of kind of pal or buddy or champ, tiger, sport, coach, killer,
that kind of thing. Friend. Daddy-o. Young friend, chum. I think Daddy-O is a little West Side Story-ish, mid-50s. that's what I think.
Do the kids not use Daddy-O anymore?
I
need to change my homily for this weekend.
I don't think so.
Okay. I have some notes to make.
You do that. So a bub is either a young friend, a chum, a buddy, pal. It sometimes can also mean a baby. And it is also sometimes known as a pet name for a special someone who is incredibly amazing, who just takes your breath away and who you fall for again and again. The person who constantly makes you smile, the person who will always be there for you at the end of the day and will accept you for you, the person who gives you a feeling of a million butterflies whenever you two are talking. This is a great explanation as to what bub is. The person who always has the right words to say at the right time, and the person who makes you feel like the luckiest person in the world.
Is that definition coming from the International Commission for the Use of Bub? That's a very glowing and effusive definition of that word. I've only ever heard it used sarcastically, like George uses it in this scene.
I couldn't tell you. What'd you say? It was the dictionary of bubisms?
The international something like that. The Fraternal Order of Bubs.
So I actually saw a list of people whose names are Bub. So I have a short list of people that were or are known as Bub. There was an NFL player known as Bub Weller, who passed away in 1993. You have another football player who passed away in 1963, named Bub Walker. You have a NASCAR driver whose name was Bub Strickler. You have a baseball player named Bub McAtee. You have another Major League Baseball pitcher who pitched one inning for the Cleveland Indians in 1924, and his name was Bub Kuhn, Kuhn. And then you have a New Zealand poet and short story writer named Bub Bridger. So I guess it's more of a sports name.
Oh, yeah. Bub seems like a MLB, that is a Major League Baseball name of a particular era.
Yeah, definitely sounds that way. And then I found one more Bub who's actually related to the movie business. There is a sound editor named Bub Asman, Asman. I hope I pronounced that correctly, because that's the way it should be. That's the way it sounds like it should be pronounced. And he was actually nominated for 6 Oscars for sound editing. How many of these 6 do you think he won?
Wow.
Or do you want me to tell you what the movies are first before you want to guess?
How many of the 6? I'm going to guess 3.
He won 2 of them. All right. But just look at the movies that he was nominated for. He was nominated in 1997 for Eraser, in 2001 for Space Cowboys, mm-hmm. 2007 Flags of Our Fathers, 2007 again for Letters from Iwo Jima, 2015 for American Sniper, and in 2017 for Sully. So you have a guess of which of those movies he won for? It's interesting that 5 out of the 6 are Clint Eastwood movies.
I mean, Clint Eastwood knows who he likes to work with. I'm going to guess the double header of Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers.
Well, you can't win the same year for 2.
Sure you can. I believe in Bub. He's amazing.
Yes. He might be, but you know.
he was nominated both years.
No, it's the same year.
The Academy can't play with Bub.
It's the same
like
year.
That.
That's what I was saying.
Well,
you know, he was up against himself. That's what I'm saying. So he can't win both of them.
So in winning for one,
okay.
For both.
All right,
that's my answer.
Okay, so he won for Letters from Iwo Jima, which
I was right.
Which if you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend seeing it. I think it's a great perspective of the Battle of Iwo Jima from the Japanese side of things. It's much better than Flags of Our Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, they're companion movies, but still. And then the other one he won for was American Sniper in 2015.
Mm.
But I mean, just looking at this is a guy who is 73 right now. And he, if you look at his credits on IMDb, he's been in the sound department for 66 different movies.
Good for him. Good, solid audio career.
Yes.
He may be in his 70s, but he's got the ears.
Well, come on, he's working.
Man.
He's working mostly for Clint Eastwood.
Details.
So, you know, Clint Eastwood has to have those youngins around with him. You know, you know, he's 20 years younger than Eastwood. He's 19 years younger than Eastwood. So, yeah. So yeah, that's what I got about Bubs, and then Clarence's response is tut tut tut.
What an old man. That's it again. More archaisms like that. Tut tut tut. Yeah, I want more of the 18th century in Clarence's speech.
Yeah, more or less. That's what it comes down to. It's usually something. It's usually a sound that people make with their tongue. It's like clicking with your tongue by doing tut tut tut. It's like a tis tis tisk. You know, I remember as a kid, I would read like Archie comics, and you'd have TSK TSK TSK. You know, I always wondered, what does that mean? It just doesn't, it's not a word.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it took a while till someone explained to me that it's just, you know, someone's making a sound, you know, they're clicking their tongue at the same time.
Mm.
That's what you do there. And once again, the name Tut, I'm assuming there's at least one that you've heard of.
King Tutankhamun of Egypt, of the cursed tomb.
King Tut,
fame.
Who was a villain of in the Batman campy series from the 1960s, yeah. And then there's a few more. Again, most of half of them are sports figures. You have there was a tennis player whose nickname was Tut, Bernard Bartson. I have no idea why he was called Tut. Then you have a football player in the NFL named Tut Imlay. And then you have a painter named Rupi Tutt, who is an Indian-born American painter. Then you have a bluegrass musician named Tutt Taylor. And this is my favorite. The first foreign minister of Burma was named Tin Tut.
Did you say Tim Tut?
Tin.
Tin
Tut. As like the Tin Man.
Oh.
The Tin Man of Tut. Yeah. And and then George starts to, you know, come once again to the realization as to whether, you know, what is worthy in life. And he goes, well, I found it out a little too late. I'm worth more dead than alive. And then Clarence tries to talk him out of it and say, now look, you mustn't talk like that.
And it's so interesting that George does talk like that, because that's the line that Potter says.
That's right.
And so that's how far gone George is. He's internalized the lies of Potter, of all people. That's the voice that's ringing most in George's head.
Is that a lie?
Well, you were the one saying that yesterday, that a life is worth way more than $8,000.
Oh, yes. No, but so I'm saying no.
Is the life? So are you saying the life insurance policy is actually the worth of George's life?
No. What I was saying is I thought you were saying that Potter was lying to him.
Well, yeah, but in the metaphysical sense, Potter was saying you're worth more dead than alive, which is not true. It's not a lie on the facts, but
no, but it's from right from that perspective, yes. But Potter is looking at it just from a financial aspect, you know, because he doesn't see worth in a life if there's no money, you know. So from Potter's perspective, there is truth there. You know, I think Potter truly believes that. You know, he's not trying to convince George that he's lying about it. Potter truly believes that. You know, the equity that he has in his life insurance policy basically means that he is worth more alive, worth more dead than alive. You know, I don't think
For Potter to be wrong about that, it's not a matter of his belief. Potter is giving voice to a lie, and no matter how much you believe it, it still doesn't make it right if it doesn't line up with the truth of life.
Oh, for sure. I completely agree with you on that. I'm just saying that it's not as if Potter is making up a lie here. That's what I'm saying. I'm defending the fact that Potter is saying, Potter said that for selfish reasons, but he truly believed it. Because Potter obviously is not a spiritual person. You know, there's no one can argue that Potter looks at things from a spiritual perspective. You know, he is completely someone who just looks at the here and now.
And what he's done is he's infected George with that mindset.
Yes,
because
correct.
George gets confirmation because he's caught up in the material benefits he's able to provide, and his failure to do so is reinforced by Potter's own worldview. And so this is where George needs that perspective to stop back. If he could just hear how this it has come out of the mouth of Potter and is now coming out of his mouth, that of all things should pull George up short and realize, wait a minute, what am I doing repeating Potter's lines? I've never agreed with that guy. Why would I start now?
That's right. And Clarence then tries to convince him otherwise by saying, now look, you mustn't talk like that. I won't get my wings with that attitude. That's a very selfish line.
But that's what I was saying. This sounds very self-serving for Clarence. Now, there's maybe a shade of interpretation you can give it that he's trying to play to George's charitable nature, that, like, look, come on, you said you're going to help me out. I'm not going to get my wings with that attitude. So, you know, let me help you so that way you can help me. Remember what you said. But
yeah.
On the face of it, yeah, it's a little egocentric of Clarence. So it is not as though Clarence is empty of all ambition. And maybe this is why he hasn't gotten his wings yet. Maybe there's still some purification that Clarence needs to go through, some purgation, one might say.
Yes. Well, again, they haven't sent him to go do any jobs on Earth. So obviously he's not going to be able to win those wings. So I don't know. And then he continues to say, but you just don't know all that you've done. If it hadn't been for you, yeah, if it hadn't been for me, everybody'd be a lot better off. My wife and kids and my friends. I mean, look, little fella, go off and haunt somebody else, will you? No, you don't understand. I've got my job. Again, he sounds very selfish.
He does sound very selfish. He's also trying to directly confront the lie that George is living in, this false self-perception. But the problem is when and this is something I've encountered in my own pastoral ministry, when someone has this idea of shame in their life, or they're living within this lie, it's not enough just to tell someone that they're wrong. You know, it's like if someone is sad, you can't just say, hey, be happy, just don't be sad anymore. You know, not a winning strategy, not often going to work. With some people, maybe sometimes. So it's not enough for George to be told his worthiness. What he needs is to experience it, which is going to, you know, cause Clarence in the scene to kind of stop. It's like, oh, this is going to be as easy as I thought. Because for Clarence, first it was jump in, save him. Aha, there, George acted for someone else's good. He's back to normal. Okay, that didn't work. Let me just tell him how worthy he is. That doesn't work either. What am I going to do? How are we going to get over this?
Well, as we said the other day, he's got like 50-something steps in order to help George here. You know, it's not a one-step process.
He certainly thought it was going to be. Like, yes. Oh, this isn't going to be so easy, is what he says. So I think Clarence, in his simplicity, imagined kind of a one, maybe two-step plan. But he's flexible enough to come up with something on the fly. He doesn't double down on something that's clearly not working.
Mm-hmm. You know, George is looking at it that everyone will be better off without him, you know, which was something that he was already thinking when he contemplated, you know, committing suicide. They say that the act of suicide is a selfish one because you're not thinking about everyone else around you. But at this point, from George's perspective, it's the exact opposite. He's only thinking about everyone around him. He's not thinking of himself. He's saying, I'm not worth of anything, and everyone else will be better off if I'm not around.
Which, in its own way, is a warped view, because
It's a warped view.
Viewing himself as the center of everybody's universe, that he is so awful, he's dragging everybody else down, as if everybody's lives were only defined by him. Now, that's we're going to see in the counterfactual of the last 25 minutes of the movie. There is some truth to that in the story that's being told.
But in a positive perspective, not a negative one.
Exactly. And I'm of the opinion that the last 20 minutes of this movie is more of a vision than an alternate history, that there is a clear moral purpose to what's being communicated. And so I think there's perhaps some exaggeration that is being shown to George in the course of this to help get his head on straight.
You're saying a vision in the way that maybe someone did spike his drink?
Oh, I'm saying a vision in the sense of how angels usually appear to people in scripture, the sense of the encounter with the divine and in a way of interacting with reality that's at a higher pitch than our ordinary life.
Okay, that's fair. And at this point, George just tells him to shut up.
He's done humoring him. He's been good-natured up to this point, but clearly just jollying this guy along isn't going to get him to leave him alone. So
that's
George is just going to wallow in his self-pity for a little bit here.
And then Clarence mutters to himself, oh, this isn't going to be so easy. And then he turns to him and goes, so you still think killing yourself would make everyone else feel happier, eh? And he goes, well, I don't know. I guess you're right. I suppose it would have been better off if I'd never been born at all. And I mean, Henry Travers does a great job here because we see a double take basically on his face. And he goes, what'd you just say? And he says, I wish I'd never been born. Oh, and you know, at this point that's where this minute ends. But I mean, first of all, this is a great conversation. The way that they build up this conversation where it starts off in one place and easily reaches a completely different solution that I'm assuming at the time, very few people even thought of even as a possibility, even in fiction, to think about the fact that, okay, what, you know, maybe we can, you know, create something fresh and new with this idea here, which is obviously what they did.
It's the whole hinge of the story, this idea of I wish I'd never been born, which is not a new idea in terms of a lament. That you can see that in scripture. Job, who says, oh, curse the day that I was born. Curse the man who brought the news to my mother. Your boy is born to you. Cursed. So there's this idea of old idea that, you know, just from the day of birth, everything's just been misfortune and awful and dark and terrible. But the whole hinge of the movie is on this as a possibility for conversion. And I think it's really significant in the telling of the story that this idea comes from George. he is the hinge of this new possibility, and we'll see how this pays off in tomorrow's minute. But just in his own process of conversion, this idea comes from George. And again, Clarence, at first he's poo-pooing this idea because it's an awful thing to say, and it makes sense. So if we ever heard one of our friends like, oh, I just wish I'd never been born, our reaction is, of course, to lean into the negative, like, no, don't say that, don't be so hard on yourself. And Clarence does the same things. It's a marvel in this movie how it plays with that idea for the rest of the film.
Right. It's true. I mean, we never really touched upon this over the last few days that you've been here, but what's your background with this movie? I mean, you mentioned that it was something that you watched in your yearly, on an annual basis with your family around Christmas time. But besides that, like, do you remember the first time you saw it?
This is one of those movies that has always existed. I've always been aware from as long as I can remember that this movie has been around, whether it's from seeing the cover of the VHS tape and children, a VHS is like a streamed movie, but on magnetic tape. Anyway, it's on this VHS tape, and that was in our parents' cabinet. It came out every Christmas, and over the years, what I found, I understood the overall plot of the movie, but every year when I watch it again, it hits me harder and harder, because as I get older and older, I can see myself in George at this stage of the movie. I'm at the time of this recording, I'm 36. I'm going to turn 37 this year. I feel pretty established in my life as a priest. I know that there were decisions I made when I was younger in order to be where I am. And I can understand more and more that feeling of resentment that George holds on to. Did I make the right decision? Did I make the right sacrifices? Is it all worth it? Am I good enough? Am I worthy enough in where I am right now? And this is a movie kind of about a midlife crisis for George, that everything he's built just suddenly seems to be about to be taken away from him. And all of his success has been on, for him, his success has to be defined in material terms, because that's how he's been thinking. And the turn of the movie is to turn away from the material towards the relational, towards the community, towards family. And that's facilitated by these divine interventionary powers, that there is a force bigger than our lives that is interested in our welfare and is going to draw us slowly and gently through a nice, kindly soul like Clarence Oddbody, perhaps, toward a right understanding. And so the older I get, the more and more I love this movie. I cry like a baby at the end of this film. Just tears everywhere. Just whole boxes of Kleenex are necessary.
So it's a good thing I don't have you on the last week. That's what you're saying, right?
Oh, that I did not ask for those minutes for a period, because I would just be a blubbering mess all week long.
Yeah, that wouldn't be good. Do you know how old Jimmy Stewart was when he made this movie?
I don't.
He was 37.
Well, how about that? Ooh, boy. I'm going to be thinking about that for the rest of the week. Oh, my goodness gracious.
And how old do you think Frank Capra was?
Oh, I don't know.
He was 48 when he made this movie.
Okay.
And that's a perfect segue to get to today's segment. Every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra movies. So why don't you once again start with your number five and work your way up?
Well, it just so happens, good listeners, that my top five Capra movies are also the five Capra movies that I have seen.
Well, that's better than some of my other guests who haven't seen five. So there you go.
Oh, well, all right, good. I was worried that I was an insufficient Capra fan. So good. So number five, Arsenic and Old Lace. Black comedy about old ladies killing people and their son who thinks he's Teddy Roosevelt burying them in the basement. I mean, hilarious. Just a really madcap black comedy, and a really great performance from Cary Grant in it. Then number four, You Can't Take It With You, which I find fascinating in comparison with this movie, because it's Lionel Barrymore as the father of this very eccentric family. And you would not recognize him. If all you know Lionel Barrymore from is Potter, watch it, You Can't Take It With You, and just see the range this man has. And I mean, you can hear it in the voice, you can kind of see it, but his characterization is just so strong in both of these films. But You Can't Take It With You, it's a great heartwarming movie overall.
Yeah.
Number three, as already mentioned, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. That movie also knocks me flat at the end of the film. The avoidance of a particular character making a very bad decision at the end of the movie. Let me put it that way. It really struck me how close and how badly things could have gone at the end of that movie. And that has always really sat with me and resonated with me. Number two, It Happened One Night. I don't know if there is a better example of a romantic comedy. It really sets the form for every romantic comedy that comes after it. The interplay of the characters, the growth in the romantic tension that's throughout the film, the whole, odd setup of the cross-country journey. That movie is just phenomenal on so many levels. And lastly, number one, once again, it's got to be this movie. It has to be It's a Wonderful Life. It's a movie I watch almost every year at this point. There's just so much happening at Christmas time as a priest. It's some years I don't get to see It's a Wonderful Life.
Come on, but priorities, priorities.
Well, I love Jesus more than I love Jimmy Stewart.
Okay,
but It's a Wonderful Life. It's a phenomenal film and really speaks to Frank Capra's ability to take a story that it wasn't exactly a popular work. It was a short story, but he built it up into a movie, and it was just part of the package of movies that he was making for the studio. It wasn't a big project, but it has become this really penetrating insight into human nature and this classic story that's beloved by so many people.
That is very true. All right, great. So would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
You can find me at my website at fatherdavidmowry.com, where I will have a listing of all my various Movies by Minutes appearances. And I don't just talk about Capra movies or superhero movies or even Star Wars movies. We get into some of these deeper metaphysical questions as well. So if you want to hear some, you can listen to my appearance on 5 Minutes of Arrival, where Robert E.G. Black and I talk about the sci-fi movie Arrival and what kind of questions are prompted by the appearance of not quite angels, but beings from beyond, and what that means about us as humans when we interact with them.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.